Welcome to today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Monday. Oh, goodness. It's January 15th. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker, and here is our first story. Principal in Perry School shooting dies. Dan Marburger risked his life to protect students January 4th. Out of Des Moines, an Iowa principal who put himself in harm's way to protect students during a school shooting earlier this month died Sunday. A funeral home confirmed. Caldwell Parish Funeral Home and Crematory confirmed the death of Perry High School Principal Dan Marburger after the family announced it on a GoFundMe page. Marburger was critically injured during the January 4th attack, which began in the school's cafeteria as students were gathering for breakfast before class. An 11-year-old middle school student was killed in the shooting, and six other people were injured. The 17-year-old student who opened fire also died of an apparent self-inflicted gunshot. The day after the shooting, the State Department of Public Safety said Marburger acted selflessly and placed himself in harm's way in an apparent effort to protect his students. News of Marburger's death was first posted on a GoFundMe page for his family. The post by Marburger's wife, Elizabeth, said he died at about 8 a.m. Sunday and said, "Dan lost his battle. He fought hard and gave us 10 days that we will treasure forever." The news that Marburger died triggered a flood of support on the Perry Facebook page, with nearly 200 people posting condolences within the first hour after it was posted. Iowa Republican Governor Kim Reynolds offered her condolences. "Our entire state is devastated by the news of Dan Marburger's death," she said in a statement Sunday. "Dan courageously put himself in harm's way to protect his students and ultimately gave his own life to save them. He will forever be remembered for his selfless and heroic actions. May he rest in peace." Reynolds ordered all flags in Iowa to be lowered to half-staff on Sunday and to remain that way until sunset on the day of Marburger's funeral and interment. People, businesses, schools, and local governments also were encouraged to fly the flag at half-staff for the same length of time as a sign of respect, the statement said. In a Facebook post on the night of the shooting, the principal's daughter, Claire Marburger, called her father a gentle giant and said it wasn't surprising that her father tried to protect his students. "As I heard of a gunman, I instantly had a feeling my dad would be a victim, as he would put himself in harm's way for the benefit of the kids and his staff," his daughter wrote. "That's just Dad." Marburger had been principal since 1995. Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation spokesman Mitch Mortvedt said after the shooting that Marburger did some pretty significant things to protect others, but didn't release details. Perry Superintendent Clark Wicks said Marburger was a hero who intervened with a teenage gunman so students could escape. An 11-year-old sixth grader, Amir Joliffe, was killed in the shooting. Authorities said he was shot three times. The shooting happened just after 7:30 a.m. on January 4th. Shortly before classes were set to begin on the first day back after winter break. Mortvedt said the shooting started in the cafeteria where students from several grades were eating breakfast, then spilled outside the cafeteria but was contained to the north end of the school. Authorities said the suspect, identified as Dylan Butler, had a pump-action shotgun and a small-caliber handgun. Mortvedt told the Associated Press that authorities also found a pretty rudimentary improvised explosive device in Butler's belongings and that experts advised it was something that they needed to disarm. It was rendered safe. The GoFundMe page for Marburger was further updated on Sunday. "All the Marburger family and the entire Perry community will forever be touched by the selflessness of Mr. Marburger. This GoFundMe will continue to be used for the Marburger family as they process through and live out Dan's legacy," it said. Our next story, it's caucus day. Here's how to participate. It's caucus day in Iowa, and thousands of Iowans will head to churches, schools, and community centers across the state to participate in political party meetings. The National Weather Service is predicting a high temperature of 4 degrees below zero in Cedar Rapids today, with wind chill values as low as 35 degrees below zero. A wind chill warning will remain in effect until noon on Tuesday. Republican and Democratic caucuses will begin at 7 p.m. at their designated precinct locations. While Iowa Republicans will cast their votes for the presidential nomination, Democrats will express their presidential preference using a new mail-in process and won't announce results until March 5th. Democrats will gather tonight to hold party organizing precinct caucuses. Democrats can request a presidential preference card at iowademocrats.org/caucus. The last day to submit a request is 5 p.m. February 19. Preference cards will be mailed starting January 12. To find your caucus location, first you must find your regular voting precinct at the Iowa Secretary of State's website, sos.iowa.gov. Then you must find your caucus site on your political party's website. For Republicans, that is www.iowagop.org/2024/caucus/locations. For Democrats, it's iowademocrats.org/caucus. Any person voting at a precinct caucus must be a registered voter and resident of Iowa and a registered member of the political party living in the precinct in which they intend to caucus. Iowans may register to vote or change their party affiliation at the caucus. Iowans also can register to vote in person on the day of the Iowa caucuses by showing up to their caucus site and bringing documents, including ID and proof of residency. I'm going to turn to government notes. Friday's change in 2024-25 Cedar Rapids school calendar. Also, Iowa City offering matching grants for public art. Students in the Cedar Rapids Community School District will no longer get out of school early on Fridays next school year, according to a new school calendar approved by the Cedar Rapids School Board last week. For nearly a decade, Cedar Rapids schools have shortened the academic day for students one day a week to make time for staff professional learning. But the new school calendar for the 2024-25 school year foregoes half days. Instead of weekly half days, the new calendar sprinkles 15 professional learning days throughout the school year on either Mondays or Fridays, including 4 days before the first day of school in August and 3 days in January. Students will not have school on these days. The new calendar, school leaders say, will maximize instructional time, promote the health and well-being of staff, and provide staff adequate professional learning opportunities. The first day of school for students this fall will be August 23, 2024. The last day of school is scheduled for June 3, 2025. Winter break is 2 weeks starting on December 23rd and resuming on January 6, 2025. Thanksgiving break is November 27th through 29th, and spring break would be March 17th through the 21st of 2025. The school calendar can be found online at crschools.us/calendars. Cedar Rapids sets meeting on student behavior. The public is invited to a Cedar Rapids School District virtual meeting later this month to hear an update on student behavior strategies as a part of a settlement agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice. Community members can submit questions and comment on these behavior strategies beforehand on this Google form at tinyurl.com/yw2eabf, and those are all lowercase letters. The meeting is Thursday and will be streamed on the district's YouTube page at youtube.com/ENGAGE(CR)schools. The district entered into a settlement agreement with the Department of Justice in September 2022 after an investigation found the school district had inappropriately and repeatedly secluded and restrained students with disabilities as early as kindergarten in violation of Title II, which prohibits discrimination based on disability, of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Under a settlement agreement, the district had to limit its use of restraints, revise its restraint procedures and practices, and consistently implement those procedures and practices in all schools. All instances of restraint must be reported and evaluated, and counseling and other services must be offered to students who are restrained. The district stopped the use of seclusion rooms in all school buildings and programs beginning October 10th of 2022 as a part of the settlement agreement. Seclusion rooms are used in many Iowa school districts as a last resort if students are at risk of harming themselves or others. Iowa City offering public art grants. Iowa City's Public Art Advisory Committee has opened the 2024 matching grant program for visual, audio, and performance-based art projects within the Iowa City limits and freely accessible to the general public. The 50-50 matching grants are capped at $4,000, which will require documented total project costs of at least $8,000. The minimum grant is $500 for a project costing at least $1,000. All projects must be finished during calendar year 2024. Art that will be considered for the awards includes sculpture, murals, performances, interactive exhibits, video projections, soundscapes, the spoken word, and other media. The most competitive projects, the city said, will be those that are functional, ephemeral, in unexpected places, or with a participatory element. Proposals will be accepted through 11:59 p.m. March 15. Grants will be announced in April. The application and additional information on selection criteria, submission requirements, eligible expenses, and other requirements for the program are available at icgov.org/publicart. For more information, contact Rachel Kilberg Varley at 319-356-5248 or RKILBURG, that's all lower caps, RKILBURG at iowa-city.org. Musicians needed for Marion Arts Series. Marion is seeking local musicians willing to perform Friday nights, June through August, at the Pup Up Acts on the Uptown Artway stage. Those interested in performing may send an email with links to video or audio clips to events@cityofmarion.org. The Arts Series is sponsored by Iowa Appliance Center. Cedar Rapids okays raises for city attorney and clerk. The Cedar Rapids City Council last week approved pay raises for the city clerk and city attorney following December 19th annual performance evaluations. City attorney Vanessa Chavez was granted a 4% increase, and city clerk Alyssa Van Slotten received a 5% pay bump, effective January 1st. In fiscal 2023, Van Slotten was paid $105,182, and Chavez's pay was $188,415. Lynn changing some department hours. Lynn County's Finance and Budget and Communications Departments, as well as the Board of Supervisors' Office, are changing their hours. Darren Gage, Lynn County's Policy and Administration Director, said numerous county departments already close at 4:30 instead of 5 p.m. weekdays. The departments generally open at 7:30 a.m. By changing the Finance and Communications Department hours, they will be in line with the other departments housed at the Gene Oxley Lynn County Public Service Center at 935 2nd Street Southwest. "I don't think that this will impact the public's ability to access us," Supervisor Ben Rogers said last week. Our next story, millions face below zero temps as weekend storms hit country. Well, we're familiar with that. This is out of the Associated Press. Sub-freezing temperatures across much of the U.S. left millions of Americans facing dangerous cold over the weekend as Arctic storms knocked out electricity to tens of thousands in the Northwest, brought snow to the South, and walloped the Northeast with blizzard conditions that forced the postponement of an NFL game. An estimated 95 million people nationwide were under weather warnings or advisories Sunday for wind chills below zero. Forecasters said the severe cold was expected to push as far south as northern Texas, while the bitter blast could push wind chills as low as 70 degrees below zero in Montana and the Dakotas. "It takes a matter of minutes for frostbite to set in," the South Dakota Department of Public Safety said in a statement Sunday, urging people to stay indoors. In Buffalo, New York, where snowfall of 1 to 2 feet was forecast, severe conditions led officials to postpone the Buffalo Bills-Pittsburgh Steelers NFL playoff game from Sunday to today. Workers with shovels and trucks worked to clear snow from the field at Buffalo's Highmark Stadium as the Bills warned volunteers eager to help with the stadium shoveling to stay at home and not defy a travel ban on area roads. Zach Taylor, a National Weather Service meteorologist in College Park, Maryland, warned some parts of the Northeast would see intense snowfall and extreme winds with gusts up to 50 miles per hour possible. "That's why we're expecting to see near blizzard conditions at times," Taylor said. Across the country in Oregon, more than 137,000 homes and businesses were without electricity, most of them in the Portland metro area, a day after high winds and a mix of snow and ice brought down trees and power lines. Given the extent of the damage and the high level of outage events, restoration efforts will continue into the week and customers are encouraged to plan accordingly, Portland General Electric said in a statement. The utility said it was watching a second weather pattern that could bring high winds and freezing rain on Tuesday. The City of Portland Bureau of Environmental Services said its crews were working around the clock at multiple locations to make emergency repairs and prevent sewage releases into homes and businesses. Portland's largest sewage pump station, which serves downtown and the surrounding inner city, was under partial service due to frozen pipe. Widespread power outages affecting tens of thousands were also reported Sunday in Michigan, New York, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Airports across the country were impacted. More than half of flights into and out of Buffalo Niagara International Airport were canceled. Scores of flights also were canceled or delayed at Chicago O'Hare International Airport and the Denver and Seattle Tacoma airports. Forecasters also warned that rapid bursts of heavy snow and wind could cause drastic and sudden drops in visibility in eastern Pennsylvania and parts of northern New Jersey and Delaware, with some near whiteout conditions possible. Another Arctic storm that's dumped heavy snowfall in the Rockies was forecast to push further south, potentially bringing 4 inches to 6 inches of snow to parts of Arkansas, northern Mississippi, and west Tennessee. Juan Villegas wore layers of clothing beneath his heavy coat Sunday as he and roughly a dozen subcontractors in downtown Des Moines shoveled away a blanket of snow, which also covered park benches and partially buried fire hydrants the day before the state's presidential caucuses. Working in temperatures of 15 below zero, Villegas said the best way to feel warm was to just keep moving. If you stay doing nothing, it's when you really feel the cold, Villegas said. Much of Wisconsin was under advisories through this afternoon with predicted wind chills as low as 30 degrees below zero. Okay, we have a Curious Iowa article, How Did MLK Day Become MLK of Service? Today's national holiday is a day on, not a day off. This is by Bailey Sacone. Today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day of Service, the only federal holiday that is designated as an official day of service. But how did it become a day of service, and what does that mean? Curious Iowa is a series from the Gazette that answers readers' questions about our state, its people, and the culture. One curious Iowan wondered about the origins of MLK Day. We looked back on King's visits to Iowa and spoke with Iowans about what the day means and how Iowans are marking it this year. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was a civil rights leader, human rights advocate, and Nobel Peace Prize recipient. In the 1950s and 1960s, he led a nonviolent movement for equal rights for Black Americans. King is best known for his I Have a Dream speech, which he gave at the March on Washington on August 28, 1963. In the speech, King said that despite slaves being freed by the Emancipation Proclamation, 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. King dreamed of a day when people would be treated equally, regardless of the color of their skin. But while King is often remembered for that speech, Lanisha Cassell, executive director of the African American Museum of Iowa in Cedar Rapids, said so many neglect to recall his disappointment in the leadership of our nation with regard to justice and equality for all people. I think more of us need to become familiar with his letter from Birmingham Jail, which in many ways reads like a current piece. On April 12, 1963, King was arrested for his participation in a series of coordinated sit-ins and marches in segregated Birmingham, Alabama. While in jail, King acquired a copy of a newspaper that had printed A Call for Unity, written by 8 white clergymen in response to the demonstrations. The authors urged protesters to stop demonstrations and instead rely on the justice system. In the margins of that newspaper, King began to write his response. King wrote that Black Americans have waited more than 340 years for their constitutional and God-given rights. In the letter, King wrote that they must demand immediate change. We know through painful experience that freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed. Between 1959 to 1968, King visited many Iowa colleges and universities, including Grinnell College, Cornell College, Coe College, the University of Iowa, and Iowa State University. In these visits, he spoke about race relations and taking nonviolent action in the struggle for freedom and justice. On October 16, 1962, King spoke to a crowd of about 1,200 people at Coe College in Cedar Rapids. King's speech promoted brotherhood and called for the end of segregation. Although he is often remembered for his work in the civil rights movement, King advocated for justice and unity for all people. We must live together as a brotherhood, or perish together as fools. No nation can live alone, as no individual can live alone, King said. But how can one avoid being depressed when we see millions go to bed hungry each night and millions sleeping on sidewalks? We spend millions building military bases when we could spend millions more to end world hunger and promote brotherhood. On April 4, 1968, King, who was 39, was assassinated while standing on a hotel balcony in Memphis, Tennessee. He was in Memphis to support black sanitation workers striking for better pay. On April 8, 1968, Michigan Representative John Conyers introduced MLK Day to Congress. Conyers, with New York Representative Shirley Chisholm, introduced the bill into every session of Congress until it was signed into law in 1983. MLK Day is held on the third Monday of January, rather than King's actual birth date. This year, the holiday happens to fall on King's birthday, January 15th. In 1994, the King Holiday and Service Act was made law by President Bill Clinton. The law designated the holiday as a day of service. King's widow, Coretta Scott King, said, "The greatest birthday gift my husband could receive is if people of all racial and ethnic backgrounds celebrated the holiday by performing individual acts of kindness through service to others." Illinois in 1973 was the first state to recognize MLK Day. Iowa observed its first state MLK holiday in 1989. By 2000, all 50 states recognized MLK Day as a state holiday. This year, communities across Iowa are celebrating the holiday in different ways. In Cedar Rapids, the African American Museum of Iowa is hosting a presentation and activities at 2 p.m. at Mount Zion Baptist Church, 6621 C Avenue Northeast. I hope Iowans take away that community service is a wonderful way to engage and get to know one another and better understand the needs that exist, particularly as it relates to the variety of resources available in our communities that address basic needs, Gassell, the museum's executive director, said. It is equally important to understand and commit to actions that demand a just society for all people and in all facets of the systems in which we live, including education, government, finance, housing, and criminal justice. In Iowa City, the MLK Day of Service event is part of the annual Martin Luther King Jr. Celebration of Human Rights Week, which is a collaboration between the city, the Black Voices Project, the University of Iowa, and various nonprofits. The theme of this year's celebration is literary outreach and book access. Mallory Simser, Iowa City's Parks and Recreation Program Supervisor for Adaptive and Inclusive Recreation and Outreach, said she chose the theme based on recent state legislation that restricts the books available in school libraries. A lot of those book bans are based off of race-related information, Smizer said. So you know, making sure that there's access to information, access to histories that maybe aren't always focused on that, can help spark and generate change for future generations. It's really important. The event kicks off today with a peace march held by the Black Voices Project at 9:30 a.m. at United Action for Youth, 1700 South 1st Avenue, number 14. The march will end at Mercer Park Aquatic Center, 2701 Bradford Drive, where programming will continue. This year's service project is making and decorating 8 little free libraries. A book drive is being held to furnish the libraries. Smizer said they appreciate donations of multi-language books. The little free libraries will need homes. Interested parties can contact airoutreach@iowa-city.org. They'll just have to basically install them and then take care of them and make sure they provide books, Smizer said. Iowa City Public Library will also hold MLK Day Family Storytime at 10:30 a.m. at the library at 123 Lynn Street. The kids that are attending our programs in the library are very little, but they're never too young to learn and to get those beginning concepts. Angie Pilkington, Children's Programming Coordinator, said, "So I hope it's a great conversation starter for parents to have with their kids, not just on that day, but every day, and to really honor Dr. King's legacy." Throughout the month of January, the Iowa City Public Library will host the Dr. King series for youth at 5 p.m. on Fridays at United Action for Youth Swaim Center, 355 Iowa Avenue. Adult Programming Coordinator Jason Palios said participants will read through and discuss poetry, short essays, and art. The discussions will incorporate advocacy, which was central to King's work. Palios said he hopes participants come away with a better understanding of their neighbors, and then to have concrete action steps that you could take in your community, just little ways that you can make differences in people's lives, but also to feel more empowered in that way. That's something that's big for the teen generation right now, Palios said. He referenced the walkout held last Monday in response to the school shooting in Perry earlier this month. There's a lot of advocacy happening at a school-age level, and so this is just another way to help them find ways to do that. Okay, I'm going to turn to the opinion section, Insight with the Community Letters. Our first one, January 6 riots seared into our memories. On Wednesday, January 6, 2021, my husband drove me to a chemotherapy appointment. We listened to NPR on the way. The Trump mob had not yet breached the Capitol. By the time I finished my treatment, they had. We had both been attentive to the election news and the spoiled child tantrums of the defeated incumbent. We were glued to the television for the rest of the day and most of the several following days. We heard and saw a howling, wild-eyed horde of Trump idolaters shove, push, hit, and beat police officers and anyone else who tried to prevent them from infesting, defiling, and trashing that hallowed building. We heard and saw these MAGAs call police. Let me start that sentence again, I'm sorry. We heard and saw these MAGAs call black officers the N-word, bay for Nancy Pelosi and Mike Pence's blood. To deny the lawless spree we saw, spearheaded by Trump, would be to set our powers of observation and reason at naught. Officers Fanon, Dunn, and Gonal were beaten like animals. 5 people died, 170 police officers were wounded. Our lawmakers and their staff were terrorized, and their workplace was indeed trashed. On November 23, 1963, September 11, 2001, and January 6, 2021, are indelibly seared in our memories. I would not vote to put that orange hominid life form back in office with a gun to my head, and I am damn sick of the threats of civil war should Trump not be elected. That letter was from Ann Treanor of Cedar Rapids. Our next letter, denying extra summer meal funds, dismaying. My heart aches for those who are about to lose food assistance during the summer months with Governor Kim Reynolds' latest decision. A $29 million federal aid package is nothing to toss into the wastebasket. It would provide $40 per child each month during the 3 summer months. We're talking just over $1 a day. It's hard to understand how she can explain how that will cause child obesity issues. Food is a basic need for growing children, and to deny them this is dismaying. Ask any elderly person who knows just how much the price of food has increased over the past few months. It becomes more and more difficult with a lower income. No child should go hungry via a governor's thoughtless plan. I guarantee you her family or others with higher incomes will not go hungry. I bow my head in shame over this Iowa decision. And that was from Janice Carson of Marion. And now we're going to turn to the obituaries. David Gordon Tibbett, 70, of Greeley, passed away on Saturday, January 13, from complications of a stroke at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City. Survivors include his 2 sons, Jerry, spouse Wendy Tibbett of Fairbank, and Alex, spouse Sarah Tibbett of Louisville, Kentucky. 3 grandchildren, Tessa, Christopher, and Jonathan. his mother Sarah Tibbett of Manchester, two brothers, Robert spouse Lori Tibbett and Thomas spouse Susie Tibbett, both of Manchester, special friend Jean Cornwell of Greeley, and several nieces and nephews. Online condolences may be sent to www.leonardmullerfh.com. No services will be held at this time. Interment will be at a later date at Grantview Cemetery in Greeley. Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Manchester is assisting the family. Donald Tharp, Cedar Rapids, 78, when he died Tuesday, January 2nd. A celebration of life will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. on Monday, January 15th, at the Legacy Center at Murdoch Linwood in Cedar Rapids. Richard Dick Marvin Hine, 82, formerly of Bennett, entered eternity on Friday, January 12th, resting comfortably in his recliner in Prairie Hills Assisted Living in Tipton. Funeral services will be held on Friday, January 19th at 10:30 a.m. at Trinity Lutheran Church in Tipton, with Pastor Michelle Knight officiating. Luncheon will be immediately following in the Fellowship Hall, then interment with last rites will conclude at Inland Cemetery in Bennett. Visitation will be held on Thursday, January 18th from 4 to 7 p.m. at Trinity Lutheran Church in Tipton. A memorial fund to Trinity Lutheran Church has been established in Dick's memory. Online condolences may be shared at www.fryfuneralhome.com. Dick was born on April 14, 1941 in Loudon, Iowa. He was one of five sons born to Marvin and Lois Schnetty Hine. Dick, Larry, Don, Gary, and Dale grew up on a farm near Tipton. Dick graduated from Tipton High School in 1959. He was employed by Super Sweet Feeds in Tipton for 3 years and then at Alcoa as a mill worker in the Quad Cities for 42 years. On June 11, 1961, he married the love of his life, Sharon Marie Kleppe, in Loudon. Together they raised their three sons, Terry, Corey, and Judy. Three sons, Terry, Corey, spouse Judy, children Kalina, Cameron, Callie, and Kelsey, and David, spouse Sandy, with children Aubrey and Alicia, and Dick, Terry, Corey, and David. Dick was known as a master craftsman carpenter. Dick and Sharon were past members of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Bennett and later transferred their membership to Trinity Lutheran Church in Tipton, where he shared his gift of voice in the church choir for many years, as well as serving on many church committees. Dick created many treasured items for his home, his family, and his church. Dick is survived by his wife Sharon, who also resides in Prairie Hills, his three sons, Terry Hine of Bennett, Corey and Judy of Bennett, and David and Sandy of Tipton, grandchildren Kalina, Cameron, Callie, Kelsey, Aubrey, and Alicia, great-grandchildren Renly, Adrie, Benson, Maverick, Hunter, Connor, and Brooklyn, his brothers Larry Hine, Don Hine, Gary Hine, and Dale Hine, many nieces and nephews. Dick was preceded in death by his parents, Marvin and Lois Hine, and his in-laws, Sylvan and Hulda Kleppe. Dennis Edward Birkich, 73 of Cedar Rapids, passed away onto his next adventure on Thursday, January 11th. A celebration of life will be held in July. Cedar Memorial is assisting the family. Dennis was born in Cedar Rapids on July 10, 1950, to Donald and Wilma Birkich. He graduated from Jefferson High School, where he lettered in baseball. After high school, Dennis attended Iowa State University for marketing and graphic design. Dennis worked for Color Tile for 20 years, where he met his wife, Nancy Combs, during one of his training classes. They were married at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids on October 9, 1993. Their son, Grant, was born on October 6, 2008, and the family relocated to Cedar Rapids in October of 2012 to raise Grant around family. Dennis retired after 14 years with Frito-Lay and became a full-time stay-at-home father. Dennis volunteered in the lunchroom at St. Pius and was den leader for Grant's Cub Scout troop. Dennis also had a creative side he enjoyed showing off, whether it was being Santa Claus for the Fort Worth Neighborhood HOA Christmas celebrations, or for the students at St. Pius, or making a papier-mâché battlefield for Grant's army men and Legos, Dennis had a fun-loving side and a wonderful flair for art. St. Elizabeth's was Dennis's church home, and he attended regularly until the outbreak of COVID, then watched via live stream until a stroke limited his vision. Dennis is survived by his wife of 30 years, Nancy, their son, Grant, sister, Debbie, spouse, Don Stepanek, stepbrothers, Jim Lynch and Bobby, spouse, Cindy Lynch, nieces, Melissa, spouse, Jonathan Greiner, and Nicole, spouse, Jason Havlicek, nephews, Austin, spouse, Tara Lynch, Dalton, and Ryan Lynch, great-nieces, Olivia, Ava, Florian, and Tinley, great-nephews, Xander and Leo, and many cousins in Cedar Rapids, Protovin, Iowa, Florida, and Minnesota. He was preceded in death by his father, Don, mother, Wilma, stepfather, Dick Lynch, and great-nephew, Jackson Havlicek. Thank you to the wonderful staff at Mercy Medical Hospital, the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House, PT, OT, and speech therapists, as well as Dennis's various doctors who gave such compassionate care to Dennis after his strokes and hospitalization. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations for Grant's future may be directed to the family in care of Collins Community Credit Union, 1005 Blair's Ferry Road, Northeast in Cedar Rapids, or to Scout Troop No. 42, 4949 Council Street, Northeast in Cedar Rapids. Mary E. Wilhelm Bentley, 97, died January 11th. Funeral Mass will be at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, January 18th at St. Ludmilla Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids. Visitation is from 4 to 6 p.m. Wednesday, January 17th, with a rosary service at 6 p.m. at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home, 520 Wilson Avenue Southwest, Cedar Rapids. Visitation will continue a half hour prior to service time at the church on Thursday. Interment will be held at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. A complete obituary will be published on Tuesday. Colleen Redshaw, New Sharon, formerly of New Sharon, was 86 when she passed away Tuesday afternoon, January 9th, at Unity Point Health, St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. A celebration of life will be held in the near future. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made in the family's name. Holland Coble Funeral Home of New Sharon is in charge of arrangements. Colleen Marie Redshaw, the daughter of Roscoe and Marie Frances Pullman Moore, was born on October 18, 1937, in Coralville, Iowa. She graduated from New Sharon High School in 1955, then attended beauty school in Ottumwa. On June 1, 1958, Colleen was united in marriage to Vernon Redshaw at the New Sharon United Methodist Church. To this union, four boys were born: Rocky Dean, David, Michael, and Mark. While Vernon was in the service, Colleen worked at GTE in Grinnell. She also worked a short time in a beauty salon before having kids. Colleen was mainly a homemaker and continued to work part-time in hair salons after having kids. She enjoyed camping, fishing, playing cards, and traveling. She was an excellent cook and enjoyed to bake. She especially enjoyed teaching her children and grandchildren how to cook and bake. She also spent a lot of time watching ball games on TV and rooting for the Iowa Hawkeyes. Colleen was a member of the Lighthouse Church along with the Loyal Daughters and Fantastics. Her legacy will be honored by her children, David Redshaw of New Sharon, Michael, spouse Renia Redshaw of Cedar Rapids, and Mark, spouse Deborah Redshaw of Fairfax. Four grandchildren, Whitney Redshaw of Cedar Rapids, Courtney Redshaw of Cedar Rapids, Sierra, spouse Nick Bellucci of Tiffin, and J.C. Jean Chiaramonte of Cedar Falls. Six great-grandchildren, Briella, Cohen, Vea, Jacoby, Declan, and Nolan. Two brothers, John, spouse Judy Limpus of Cedar Rapids, and David, spouse Roberta Limpus of Shuiville, and many nieces, nephews, and friends. Colleen was preceded in death by her parents, her husband Vernon Redshaw in 2021, a son in infancy, Rocky Dean Redshaw, and a brother, Donald Moore. Gretchen Zeman Sturr, 94, of Cedar Rapids, died at the Birdhouse of Iowa City with family by her side on January 7th. The funeral service will be held at 11:30 a.m. Saturday, January 20th, at First Lutheran Church, 1000 3rd Avenue Southeast in Cedar Rapids. Visitation will be held at 10:30 a.m. prior to the service. Gretchen was born to Elmer and Adela Meyer Zeman in Postville on April 21, 1929. She attended Bailey No. 5, a one-room schoolhouse near her parents' farm. In eighth grade, her parents moved to town, where she then graduated from Postville High School in 1947. Gretchen chose to continue her education at Cornell College in Mount Vernon and graduated in 1950 with a bachelor's degree in music education. While there, her love of music and of musical theater flourished. She was thrilled and honored to play the title role in Gilbert and Sullivan's Iolanthe. At Cornell, she made many lifelong friends, and it was there on a blind date that she met her husband of 60 years, John H. Jack Sturr. They were married on August 19, 1950, in St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Postville. After their marriage, they made their home in Cedar Rapids, and Gretchen taught music and directed musical programs at Arthur Elementary School until she began having children. She later taught at Polk Elementary and retired from teaching in 1979. Gretchen and Jack had four children: Kristen, spouse Dennis Barnes of Minnetonka, Minnesota; Tracy, spouse Robin Lenta of Solon; John, spouse Amy of Portland, Oregon; and Mary, spouse Jim Yellen of New York, New York. She loved music in almost all its forms, whether ridiculous or elevated, operetta or oratorio, popular or classical. She played the piano and played it well for most of her life. As a part of a recorder group, mostly Renaissance and Baroque, she giggled into her 80s playing both alto and bass. She loved, loved, loved to dance. Gretchen loved to play other things besides instruments, including golf, tennis, bridge, and mahjong. She wasn't very fond of cooking, but she could make a mean batch of peanut clusters. She had a deep and abiding place in her heart for dark chocolate. She was a member of First Lutheran Church for over 70 years and sang in the choir for many of them. Gretchen's faith was intrinsic to her character. Her enduring community involvement included children's theater and puppet theater, the Monday League, various duplicate bridge groups, tourist club, the Cedar Rapids Country Club, and the Junior League of Cedar Rapids. She was an accomplished needlewoman and credited needlepoint for helping her manage the ordeal of chemotherapy when she was in her 50s. She possessed an informed sense of fashion and design and did modeling for area organizations and department stores. She could and would restore almost anything, from a kitchen chair to a baby grand piano to her scratched Honda Accord. Gretchen faced several major health obstacles with grace, fortitude, and good humor, to say nothing of determination. She was an attentive caregiver to her husband in his final years. Gretchen is survived by her four children, their spouses, and her deeply cherished grandchildren: Bethany, spouse Brian Connolly; Jordan, spouse Tom Hay; Claire, spouse Sam Reiser; Sam and Henry Huck Stewer; and Quinton and Caden Yellen, and six great-grandchildren. Preceding her in death were her husband Jack, her parents, her sister Leona Deering, and her two brothers Miles Zeman and Robert Hall Zeman, who died in infancy. Our family's warm thanks are extended to the Birdhouse, and particularly to the Essence of Life hospice staff, whose quiet, tender, and conscientious care enveloped Gretchen in the final weeks of her life. Gretchen deeded her body to the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to Essence of Life Hospice or to the Birdhouse Hospice Home in Iowa City. Lois Evelyn Livingstone Weil, 98, of Anamosa, passed peacefully into heaven on Friday, January 5th, at Pinnacon Senior Living and Memory Care in Anamosa. The family will greet friends and family from 5 to 7 p.m. on Tuesday, January 16th, at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Wednesday, January 17th, at Viola United Methodist Church, located at 221 Center Street in Viola. Interment will follow at Wilcox Cemetery in Viola. Marilyn June Blood Cole, of Arden Hills, Minnesota, formerly of Lisbon, Iowa, Huntsville, Missouri, Windsor, Missouri, took her leave of this world to enter the loving arms of Jesus on January 12th. All who knew Marilyn during her 84 years of life knew how deeply she loved her Lord, her husband, her family, and her friends. Those friends are innumerable, as Marilyn possessed a gift for immediately making others feel as if she'd known them for years, even if she'd just met them. Marilyn's life was a rich tapestry of experiences and relationships. Marilyn was born on February 17, 1939, to Bob and Lucille Blood of Lisbon, the firstborn of their four children. Marilyn would grow to spend a lifetime loving and helping children, beginning with her younger siblings, Jim, Vera, and Dennis. Moving on to her own six children, and reaching out to include any child within her church, family, or community who captured or needed her attention. Even within her hazy, incoherent final days, holding a great-grandchild allowed her to regain the clarity of mind to sing "Jesus Loves Me" from deep within her soul. There can never be any doubt that Jesus and Marilyn love children. While a schoolgirl in Lisbon, Marilyn met and eventually married the love of her life, Delmer Lee Cole, on September 25, 1957. Together, they celebrated 60 joy-filled years, marked by mutual respect, deep affection, and service to the Lord. While their life together focused on farming and raising a pastel of kids, Marilyn branched out to find other interests to fill her time when their nest emptied. Her love of flowers drew her to work in a local Windsor, Missouri greenhouse for several years, and her love for people compelled her to volunteer in local nursing homes. Much of Marilyn's happiness and contentment in life lay in the enjoyment of simple pleasures, the sight of butterflies and birds, the tranquility of flowers and her favorite color, blue, and the sweetness of a well-earned treat or the delight of creating one for others. Marilyn's life was not just defined by the love she shared with Delmer, but also by the extensive family they nurtured together. She leaves behind a legacy through her children, Samuel Lee, spouse Suzanne, Daniel Ernest, spouse Mindy, Anna Marie, spouse Scott Bruski, Dr. Andrew Ray, spouse Susan, Nathaniel Earl, spouse Lori, and Jacob Lloyd, spouse Paula Cole. Her spirit continues to resonate in the lives of her 21 grandchildren and 14 great-grandchildren, each embodying a facet of her loving nature. Marilyn loved wholeheartedly and had so much pride and joy in her large family. She loved to recite everyone's names in order with their spouses and children's names. She rarely missed a beat. As dementia took a stronger hold, she resorted to writing down the names and birth dates over and over, as she was determined not to lose touch with her life's most prized possessions. That love of family, combined with a love for her Savior, created a tremendous prayer warrior. A celebration of Marilyn's life will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, January 20th, at the Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services, Mount Vernon. Visitation for family and friends will commence prior to the service, from 9:30 to 11 a.m. She will be laid to rest at Lisbon Cemetery beside her beloved husband, Delmer. Those unable to attend are invited to watch the service via live stream. The family wishes to extend their heartfelt thanks to all who have provided support and love during this time. In lieu of flowers, they suggest donations to Foreign Missions or Coyote Hill Foster Care Ministries, a cause close to Marilyn's heart, reflecting her lifelong spirit of generosity and community support. Marjorie Hoth Heiserman of Manchester, 78 of Edgewood, formerly of Manchester, passed away on January 10th at the Edgewood Convalescent Home in Edgewood. Per her wishes, cremation has taken place. A celebration of life and interment will be held at a later date. Marge was born May 29, 1945, in Sumner to Harold and Ellen Turner Hoth. In 1965, Marge married Thomas Arlington. Two children, Christian and Christine, were born to that union. They later divorced. Marge married Roger Heiserman on June 13, 1969, and three more children, Carolyn, Carl, and Kathy, were added. Marge worked for 2001 Videos, as well as Pronto, Nabby's Super Value, and Econo Foods in Manchester. Marge is survived by her children, Christian, spouse James Arlington of Manchester, Christine Cortez, and special friend John Miller of Manchester, Carolyn, spouse Michael Walter of Cedar Rapids, and Kathy, spouse Carl Wickman of Springville. Her siblings, Joanne Hinton of Parma, Ohio, James Hath of Waterloo, Janet, spouse James Johnson of Eagle Grove, Linda, spouse Stephen Miller of Manchester, and Brenda Robson, spouse Bob Drinkwater of Appleton, Wisconsin. Grandchildren, Julia, spouse Barry Moriarty of Jacksonville, Florida, Joel Wickman, Cedar Rapids, and Malachi Finch of Manchester. She was preceded in death by both husbands, son Carl Heiserman, father and stepmother Harold and Verdell Hopp, mother and stepfather Ellen and Gerald Johnson, father and mother-in-law Carl and Tiana Heiserman, and brother-in-law David Hinton. A special thank you to staff at Edgewood Convalescent Home for caring for our mother these past years. Okay, we're going to turn to sports and let you know what's going on today. On television, we have the NFL playoffs, Steelers at the Bills at 3:30 p.m. on KGAN. The Eagles are at the Buccaneers tonight at 7 p.m. on KCRG, ESPN, and ESPN2. In the NBA, we have the Rockets at the 76ers at noon on NBA TV, the Spurs at the Hawks at 2:30 p.m. on TNT, the Warriors at the Grizzlies at 5 p.m. on TNT, Bulls at the Cavaliers, 6 p.m., NBCS in Chicago, Thunder at Lakers at 9:30 p.m. on NBA TV. Pro tennis, the Australian Open is on 11 a.m. and also at 10:30 p.m. tonight. Men's basketball, Ohio State at Michigan, 11 a.m. on KFXA. George Mason at George Washington at 1 p.m. on CBS Sports Network. Villanova at Marquette at 1:30 p.m. on KFXA. LaSalle at St. Joseph's, 3 p.m. CBS Sports Network. Iowa at Minnesota at 5 p.m. on BTN. American at Loyola, 6 p.m. on CBS Sports Network. Notre Dame at Boston College at 6 p.m. on ESPNU. North Carolina A&T at Hampton at 8 p.m. on CBS Sports Network. Women's basketball, LaSalle at St. Joseph's at 11 a.m. CBS Sports Network. Probably missed that one. Men's wrestling, Minnesota at Iowa, tonight at 7 p.m. on BTN. High school basketball, nothing we need to worry about there. On the radio, we have the NFL playoffs, Eagles at Buccaneers, 8 p.m. on KGYM. Men's basketball, you can catch Iowa at Minnesota at 5 p.m. on WMT or KXIC. And I have time for one short sports article here, and I'm going to do men's wrestling. New spotlight night for wrestling. Iowa opens work week with Monday night duel against Minnesota. It's by KJ Pilcher. College duels on Monday night are uncommon. Iowa has to go back almost 8 years since the last time they opened the work week on the mat. That time was a home duel against North Carolina State as part of the National Wrestling Coaches Association National Duels Championship Series. Third-ranked Iowa hosts number 10 Minnesota in a Big Ten Conference duel tonight at Carver Hawkeye Arena. The Hawkeyes are coming off a 22-10 road victory over number 6 Nebraska on Friday, opening conference competition. The duel with the Gophers was originally scheduled for Sunday, but was quickly changed, according to Iowa coach Tom Brands. The duel will air after the Iowa and Minnesota men's basketball game. Wrestling could increase its imprint, branching out to more days of the week. Viewership numbers will tell the tale, but Brand said the Monday duel makes sense. I think it's something they want to make room for, Brand said. I don't think there's a lot happening on Monday for the Big Ten Network. It's a great way to see how this works. Former Iowa two-time NCAA champion and four-time All-American Mark Ironside, who teams with Stephen Grace on Hawkeye radio broadcasts, recalled Thursday night duels, especially with Northern Iowa. This could be a boost for wrestling. I think people will enjoy this on a Monday evening, Ironside said. I think it's great for the sport, and we continue the fan base of our sport. Multiple duels over a weekend are common during the Big Ten schedule, like Iowa's tour east to Illinois and Northwestern on January 26th and 28th. Consecutive dates are even more common than bracket duels to the weekend. The timing isn't a factor and doesn't disrupt the Hawkeyes' routine. It's not like it was last week when they changed it, Brand said. We've known about this for a long time. We were originally Friday through Sunday. We go. If it was Friday through Saturday, we go. If it's two on Friday, we go. If it's Friday to Monday, we're ready. The Gophers, who are 5-0, have had a small resurgence but have not had a conference duel yet. They haven't competed since the Soldier Salute on December 30th at Extreme Arena in Coralville. A couple of rematches from that tournament's semifinals are expected. Iowa's number 9, Drake Ayala, earned his first win over Patrick McKee, beating the Gopher 5-4 at 125. McKee won their first four meetings in Ayala's freshman season 2 years ago. Ayala is 13-1 and has won 7 straight matches, including a decision over number 7, Jor Volk, in the Soldier Salute Finals, and a 7-3 decision over Nebraska's number 5, Caleb Smith, for his 6th victory over a ranked foe. Iowa 197-pounder Zach Glazier is expected to wrestle Garrett Joles. Glazier edged Joles 5-4 at the Soldier Salute. Glazier is 14-0 in his first season as a full-time starter, coming off an 11-2 major decision over Nebraska Big Ten champion Silas Allred. Former Crestwood and New Hampton 4-time state champion and UNI wrestler Michael Blockus is in the Gophers lineup at 157. The 6th-year graduate student is ranked 18th and will face number 2, Jared Franick. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833.